Hey everyone, welcome to this 11th talk on Meditations on the Tarot, A Journey into Christian Hermeticism. This is part 11, so it is free for everyone. If you're interested, if you enjoy this talk, if you're interested in these talks and you want access to the even numbers, which are for patrons and subscribers only, there's going to be 22 of these, so we're halfway through and half are for patrons only. So if you're interested, please find links for the Patreon in the description below and you'll have instant access to all of those talks. But anyway, on with this card. We are talking today about the 11th major arcanum of the tarot, the Marseille tarot deck, Force or La Force. So, moving in. The author, once again, begins with two quotes. "This thing is the strongest of all powers, the forcible forces, for overcome of every subtle thing and doth penetrate every solid substance." That's from the Tabula Smaragdina, page 9. And then Powerful Virgin, Merciful Virgin, Faithful Virgin from the Loretanian Litany. So this concept of the penetration of every solid substance and the idea of virginity are prevalent. They are key in this card. So we move forward. Previously, we discussed the transformation of fallen animality into holy animality, with the latter being a spontaneous obedience regarding God, with such an obedience being an instinct whereby the synthesis of these four holy animals within the symbol of the Sphinx, which we saw in the Wheel of Fortune, is an unconscious symbol in relation to the divine instinct of the kingdom of God. It's this peculiar symbol between holy and fallen animality, or animality and bestiality. And the world is full, for the author, of this implicit, instinctive, and intuitive religion. We find this in the saints, says the author, who say that even birds praise God when they sing. These small streams of life through which the beauty of the world are really homages to the beauty of God's life and gift and grace to us. So in this sense, in relation to this understanding of the small things being always in relation to God, the hope and faith are in a way revealed by a clear yes that living beings give in relation to life, by the very fact they are living, by their very preference to life over death, by the fact they prefer life to death, by the fact of these affirmations of life and nothing other than a certain testimony of the presence of God. And this affirmation of life is the meaning and purpose of being alive in itself. This sort of idea of, you know, something as small and as simple as birdsong as being both an affirmation of life, the purpose and meaning of life, and in that a clear example of a gift from God, even in the smallest thing of beauty, is itself this beneath the idea of hope and faith. And these waves of affirmation reach the unconsciousness of beings, taking effect in a form of vital energy and conviction, which underlies all those who affirm life in this way. And that is to say, life proceeding for everyone who prefers life in this way, it's clear that life proceeds via a holy source flowing from and towards an end of supreme divine worth, a gift, once again, of benediction and vocation. And for the author, he turns many, many times in this card, in his meditations on this card, to the Apocalypse of St. John. And for the author, this is expressed with remarkable clarity in the Apocalypse of St. John. So, before the throne, there is, as it were, a sea of glass, like crystal, and round the throne, on each side of the throne, for living creatures, full of eyes, in front and behind. The first living creature like a lion, the second living creature like an ox, the third living creature with the face of a man, and the fourth living creature like a flying eagle. In the four living creatures, each of them with six wings are full of eyes all round and within, and day and night they never cease to sing, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty, who was and is to come." Revelation 4, 6 to 8. And this is the working of natural religion, the presence reflected like crystal. We can, of course, understand that clear symbolism of the idea of crystal. pure, the holy animality in relation to these creatures, which never ceases in seeing the relation of the idea, which we've spoken about already in the small bird song, as a reflection in this crystal of divine presence. This is ultimately a natural reaction to divine presence in someone who has this understanding of hope and faith in relation to a divine source. To perceive and then to react, filling the unconscious core of religious creatures and living beings with that vital energy, which has many, many names throughout all cultures. You know, it's often called the Elan or Ki in Asian subcultures. Many, many names for this, and everything natural and supernatural. From this understanding of a vital energy, everything supernatural and natural originate from the same source. Therefore, the saying for the author that nature is fundamentally supernatural is profoundly true. And we can once again think back to that open and closed circle of the idea of something being able to come into the illusion of the closed circle is in its sense to do with an internal mysticism and patience on the half of the person, which allows God to come in. And we can it's all the same source, that source of all life being religion and perception of the presence of God in reaction to that presence of God as well, whether or not this perception and reaction is taking place from the holy silence. If it is or it isn't, then of course the reaction differs, and it also splits again, not into in a dualistic way, but in a value of like intensity in relation to the vertical. It splits between many of these splits that we've seen and falls on one side, with one side always having a more intense relationship, once again being the captain of the ship and not simply the passenger. And so the sea of glass that St. John in the Apocalypse here is talking about for the author, the sea of glass is the water within which we are immersed via baptism, pure water of pure light, which reflects everything in a reflection of the presence and grace of God, with the sacrament of confirmation taking place day and night via the chorus of affirmation that we've already heard about, with all these sacraments bearing forgiveness and healing to fallen nature, with the nature of our fallen selves itself being a mystery with regard to this instinctive understanding and perception and reaction once again in relation to the presence. And the author for this returns to St. John, speaking once again of the idea of the serpent, of the force of the serpent in the world. The serpent poured water like a river out of his mouth after the woman to sweep her away with the flood. The earth came to help of the woman, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed the river which the dragon had poured from his mouth. Revelation X. IIIA 1516, that's a couple of sections of Revelation there. The sea of glass then we've spoken about is its calm, its peace, its stability, its order, its purity in relation to the idea of glass as a crystal. And this is seen now in the opposition to the river, which spews out of the mouth of the serpent in a chaotic form, right? The serpent doesn't really have control. He's like gives you this force that you have to deal with, and it's pure disorder. And so here we see two different means of arriving at a conviction, and either one is illumined by the clarity of contemplation within silence, with respect to this sea of glass, with respect to this idea of being able to reflect in everything and from everything in it the presence of God. Or is once, you know, and that's something that's to do with calmness, to do with order, to do with stability, to do with a sea of glass, a sea of calm, a sea of silence, if you will, sitting in that, allowing that open circle to come in, and from that allowing, even in something as minor as birdsong, to have a reflection from the sea of the presence of God. And this is of course always in opposition to the river, which is spewing out of the mouth of the serpent in chaotic form. And this is something which sweeps one away, right? You lay in the sea of glass in calmness, in acceptance, in submission. You allow. What happens from the serpent when he spews the water is it's like a powerful river. It sweeps one away in the same way that passions sweep one away, aiming at a personal, you know, a directed, desired end, with the former being full of tolerance and patience with the sea. You know, it's tolerant, it's patient of you, it's silent. And the latter is fanatical, it's aggressive. And someone who is caught in the sweeping tide of the serpent is someone who is constantly conquesting without end because it is an aggressive act. It's a hostile act. It's opposed. It's schismatic. It's frictional. And it's this form of opposition and hostility and friction which keeps it alive. It's the greed, or the greed for faith, the greed for success alone. The reason of its existence is harking back to the idea of possessing the fruit from the tree of knowledge. It may be the case that one is allowed such knowledge via simply sitting in silence, allowing, opening. But there's a key difference, and that's where the big split is, between grabbing, taking, possessing. Okay, it's no longer afforded to you by a legitimate above in the sense of someone being a prophet. It's taken, and that is incorrect. And so here in this way, this split is actually two kinds of faith, two different ways of seeing the world, two different forms of perception. There is openness and innocence, which reflects only light, those who have eyes to see. And then there is scrutiny. There is possession. Those who seek to take hold of the world as a form of prey, as that's mine. Formerly, spirits are put to service without reserve, who are open, beautiful, and good. And then there are spirits who have an emphasis on individual will, who use their gifts to win others over to their singular cause, to sweep them away by that river of their own will. Plato, for the author, is actually an example of the former, someone who was seeking pure love, pure thought, seeking only to reflect what he could find in the pure light and what pure light compromises. In contrast to this, Karl Marx is the author of the century, who for a whole century was all about solitary human will, okay? Selfishness and possession, hey, you should do this, we should do this, individual, secular, human will. And we can see the difference between these two modes of perception in that, you know, what is owed to either of these forms of thinking with Plato and Marx? Could such a thing, the author asks us, as Christian, you know, Christian medicine, Christian healing, really exist under communism in this form, exist amidst the October Revolution and socialist revolutions? Or would the light simply be stifled by all these possessive individual wills? So the idea of the sea of glass and the notion of being swept away by a current against this is really openness versus possessiveness. The author sees here in opposition once again between animality and bestiality, or holy animality and material animality, right? With animality being holy and bestiality being degenerate. And the author turns to the idea of the beast from the book of the Apocalypse with 10 horns and 7 heads, and a beast which St. John saw rising out of the sea with another beast who rose out of the earth, a scarlet beast, and finally a false prophet, the presence of these 21 beast works with the sign of the beast, all these signs of deception. And so there is this strange emphasis for the author on this book of Apocalypse and what happens when there is this split between two spirits, one of openness and one of possessiveness, and one ends up with this possessive nature, you know, a beast of the earth, a beast of the sea. You know, it can't be of the sea. It's either an openness and acceptance and a tolerance and a patience and a silence, or it's entering into that idea of the individual will. Anyway, we are speaking of the card as usual. It takes ages to actually get through to the card. We're speaking of this card, the mystery of force, la force, force, a force which moves non-fallen nature and which moves fallen nature. It's force in general, because the principal notion force comes down to the principle of reaction, which is the implication that there are two forms of perception regarding faith we've already spoken of, openness and possessiveness. And so the author turns again to Revelation. And he speaks of a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a crown of 12 stars. She was with child. She cried out in the pangs of birth, in anguish for delivery, and a woman sitting on a scarlet beast arrayed in purple and scarlet and decked with gold and jewels and pearls, holding in her hand the golden cup full of abominations and the impurities of her fornication. And from this passage, these two different women, the former woman is a soul of non-fallen nature, and the latter is the soul of terrestrial fallen nature. The first is a mother, the second is a prostitute. The one is perception which is above, and reaction to that which is perceived through its realization. We could call this vertical perception. And the other, the latter, is horizontal perception, sterile enjoyment, possessiveness. One, ultimately, the former is the Virgin Mother, and the other is the great prostitute of Babylon, the great whore of Babylon. And we see once again here the difference between Genesis and creation, and evolution, the above and the below. And what is formed from within these, what is given from within these. And the Virgin is the principle of force. She cooperates in the realization of the supernatural acts of the Holy Spirit, which can enter into that open circle. And there is in this cooperation, and cooperation strangely with non-fallen nature, things created not from nothingness, and yet not transformations and healings. When we think of the wine at the wedding of Cana, right? This was not created from nothing. It was rather water which was changed to wine. The multiplication of the bread in the desert was not the creation of bread from nothing, but a cooperation of nature, which is always clearly evident. Nature, then, for the author, is always apparent in miracles. There has to be a cooperation between the above and the below, even though the transformation is legitimized from above, right? That miracle couldn't be there without the grace of God, but nature from below has to cooperate with it. And so nature is always apparent. Even for the author, even in the miracle of miracles, the resurrection, there had to be the disappearance of the body so it could reappear to Mary Magdalene, right? With Christ himself indicating the continuity of the body by inviting Thomas to put his fingers on the marks where the nails had been and in the wound at his side. So there's still this cooperation between the above and the below. And for the author, this signifies the fact that the virgin nature always takes part in miracles. And this is the primary subject of this card, which we're talking about, Force, a card which represents a woman victorious over a lion, holding its jaws open with her hands. And the woman does this so with apparent ease, without effort, which we've talking about before. She's clearly just holding the lion's jaw open with a strange ease, looking forward quite nonchalantly. And this is a non-effort we've spoken about in the first card. She wears a similar hat to the magician of the first card in the form of a lamantinate. And both of them equally stand under the sign of eternity. The hat is in the symbol of eternity, which symbolizes that eternal respiration, that spiritual respiration we've spoken about, of the spiritual respiration of the above and the below. And so force is understood in relation to nature, and it is thus a power without effort. Right. Force subdues the lion, but it's not the means of the force which the lion has, but rather by a legitimized force of the higher order, which simply allows this. And once again, we are seeing how things are enacted, which might seem anathema to the Christian worldview, that they had something to do with a higher order, which implies a legitimacy. So, what are we actually being taught? What's going on? It's the question we're probably all asking. What we're actually being taught here via this card, then, we're being invited to leave behind the plane of quantity, right? And to raise ourselves once again to the plane of quality. Very roughly speaking, once again, it's the horizontal and the vertical. For it cannot be the same quantity of forces that which the lion itself has. It has to be a higher quality, right? It can't be the lion has X amount of force, and so to overtake it, we need X amount of force, because that's the same quality of force. It's a force of the below. It has to be a different quality, so we're moving from quantity to quality. Okay, and thus, holy animality, which in this sense, degenerate animality of the below, obeys because of that higher quality. The card invokes non-fallen nature, that pre-fall Edenic nature. And from this, we can speak again of the serpent who is in opposition and creates friction, which produces a material energy, a material quantified force. And then we can speak of the Virgin who is in concordance, right, which creates a fusion, a cooperation. It engenders a force, a quality of force, which is legitimate. And we see this in many of the saints which have relationships with animals. There is a specific word for this, but I can't remember it right now. In the sense of the quality of this saintly force, that many of these saints, it's said, when they go back to natural places where they're animals, the bestial, degenerate, primal nature of many animals, which would otherwise attack and be vicious, goes back to that pre-full Edenic state. And you see this in many icons of saints who are you know, talking to bears or at one with animals in this sense. And we could, once again, when we turn back, this is a legitimate energy. And we see this, that the idea of the serpent's energy just isn't legitimate, because it comes from a friction and a conflict which is engendered solely in the below and releases into the world an enormous amounts of psychic energy which simply result in wars and conflict, and nothing legitimate can ever sort of neutralize it, okay? For truth of the serpent, which is non-truth, springs forth only from a clash of opinions, which is schism, which we know is not where truth is. Truth is in unification, it's in harmony. And truth never can spring forth from a combative personal will. The truth is only revealed through this form of cooperation via something which is above, something which is vertical, something which is which can legitimize the force. And that can only be something which is silent, something which is open, something which is virgin in that sense. And it's through this fusion, this cooperation, this conversation, which is the process of together reversing that opposition and controversy, right? This is the work of synthesis, which we've understood before, okay? And thus, true conversation for the author is always has in principle the underlying statement from the gospel, where two or three are gathered in my name, there I am in the midst of them. That's from Matthew 20. And so, what does that mean? All true conversation holds a transcendent center away from life. Okay. In relation to force, people often think of something such as electricity, right? But the author takes this to court and he says that life and electricity, and we can take the metaphor of electricity as that frictional blow force, life and electricity must be distinguished. Electricity is pure antagonism of opposites, whilst life is this fusion, this synthesis, this harmony, which we've been speaking about. The dragon or the serpent of old is pure opposition, that is to say, pure opposition in relation to the higher. And so we use only a terrestrial electricity of the below. There is a less electric electricity, but this is in relation to ideas such as fire, or the fire of the Lord, or the fire from above, which consumed Elijah's burnt offering. And we can see in this a clear synthesis and cooperation. It's a fire which, yes, it's of the below, but it came in cooperation with the above. Its source, with respect to life, is descended from the throne and the soul of non-fallen nature, the Virgin. And we go back to then, again, that idea of faith at the start, and the two ideas of faith as a difference between openness and possessiveness. Those who are open understand what comes, and everything comes from the source, and in that you see the good. Okay, and virginity is obedience, right? Why is this idea of the virgin always prevalent? Virginity is obedience, and therefore it is definite harmony and cooperation with the divine. And the author takes a digression on this idea. What is virginity? For he says, you know, what is force in relation to virginity? This state virginity is a relation to three principles, the spirit, the soul, and the body, with a being who is in spirit, whose spirit, soul, and body are in consonance. And the state of virginity is a principle of the unification, then, of heaven, purgatory, and earth. From the point of view of the earth, it's obedience of the body to the soul. From the point of view of purgatory, it's obedience of the soul to the breath of eternity. And from the point of view of heaven, it is absolute receptivity to the divine. And in this, we see chastity, poverty, and obedience once again. We see those three virtues which culminate and gravitate around virginity. We can see this actually in the idea of the brown scapula, who anyone who's into that. Virginity then is the unity of that which is above and that which is below. And it is this which is force. It is the actions of these three ideas in harmony, force itself being a sort of unifying principle, being the harmony of the above and the below. Before his works of old, I was set up from everlasting, from the beginning, or ever the earth was. When there were no depths, I was brought forth, when there were no springs abounding with water. Before the mountains had been shaped, before the hills, I was brought forth. Before he had made the earth with its fields, or the first of the dust of the world. When he established the heavens, I was there. When he drew a circle on the face of the deep. When he made firm the skies above. When he established the fountains of the deep. When he assigned to the sea its limits, so that the waters might not transgress his command. When he marked out the foundations of the earth, then I was at work beside him. Proverbs 22-30 once again. The principles of force and virginity are always immanent. The reality of this principle is of the divine of God. Reality, the principle of the divine world is Christ made incarnate. The principle of fertility is the productive virginity of Mary Sophia for the author. Okay, the author here is speaking of many meetings with the Blessed Virgin, right? They're so numerous and so well attested that he says that one certainly at least must admit to their objective reality. So many people have met the Blessed Virgin. And he says the fact that so many people have met the Blessed Virgin, right, recently and all throughout history, he says that this must satisfy the demands of conscience. You know, for his more than 40 years of endeavor and experience, he has been absolutely sure of one result regarding this idea of meeting the Blessed Virgin in relation to this idea of virginity and what virginity actually is in the sense of sort of spiritual respiration and growth. And for the author, one meets the Blessed Virgin inevitably when one attains a certain intensity of spiritual aspiration, an aspiration which is authentic and pure, back to that sea of glass. Attaining a spiritual sphere comprised of an intense spiritual respiration and purity of an intention which puts you in the presence of the Blessed Virgin. Okay, the meeting belongs to a certain sphere. We saw this in previous cards about when Christ had foregone and resisted the temptations of the devil, that atmosphere had been cleared out. And what did it allow? It allowed angels to come in. Okay, and so the meeting belongs to a certain sphere, to a certain spiritual experience and intensity of being. His thesis then, of the author, is everyone who seeks authentic spiritual reality will sooner or later meet the Blessed Virgin, and this meeting is the signification for the author of protection against a very serious spiritual danger. And if one is to advance in the set sense of depth and height, one day will arrive at the spheres known as the sphere of mirages, the zone of illusion for the author, and it is a zone which surrounds the earth as a belt of illusions, which is designated in the book of the Apocalypse. Babylon, the Queen of Babylon, being like a stone wall, the adversarial of the Virgin, the opposite of virginity, and one cannot pass through without being perfectly pure. One cannot traverse it without the protection of the mantle of the Blessed Virgin. It is the grace and protection of the Blessed Virgin which allows one to not fall prey to this atmosphere of illusions. Okay. And this way, as we all well know by now, is silent and solitary. It's for the author is one who follows in the way of the Roman Catholic Church as a depository of Christian spiritual truth. And the more one approaches the church, the more one intensifies their relationship with this truth. Eventually, a correspondence happens where one realizes the teachings of the church are entirely true, that there are guardian angels, that there are saints who participate actively in our lives, that the Blessed Virgin is real, and that she is precisely as she is understood, worshipped, and portrayed by the Church. The sacraments are effective. There are seven of them. There are three sacred vows, and they constitute the very essence of authentic spirituality. The prayer is a powerful means of charity. The ecclesiastical hierarchy reflects the celestial hierarchy. Hell, purgatory, heaven, these are all realities. And lastly, that Christ himself, although he loves everyone, he abides with his church, and his church is always there, and he is always present with it. And this is a very encapsulated, almost word for word, sudden digression of the author about where the authentic, true spirituality is found. And from this, the author just suddenly returns, so make of that what you will, the author returns to the idea of force, the card itself, okay? So union, harmony, synthesis, the alliance of individual wills makes force with the view of achieving a common aim. But however, this would be a quantitative increase of force, right? You know, oh, we'll all band together in quantity and increases it. Well, it's just a quantitative increase in force. With respect to the quality, would be appropriate to say that unity is force, okay? Not unity makes force, but unity is force. With regard to this unification of the spirit and the soul and the body, we've spoken about insofar as this culminates in this idea of virginity. So in the Emerald Table now, speaking primarily of Hermeticist ideas, there are two lines regarding force. Okay, the first is that it overcometh every subtle thing and doth penetrate every solid substance. Sorry, that is both of them. So firstly, we have the one, it overcometh every subtle thing. Put simply, this means to change an enemy into a friend in the sense of material wars. This means not the defeat in the sense of impotence or rendering an adversarial completely impotent. It means overcoming an adversary to such an extent that one returns to a former state where they were sincerely allied to what was once an adversary. On another plane, this would be the case in the instance if the devil was overcome in the sense that his voice would be heard in the chorus of choirs of celestial angels praising God. The author doesn't comment whether or not this could actually happen, by the way. Authentic victory that one must hope for and wait for, its conflict represented by the Battle of Heaven and the Archangel Michael and the Dragon, this battle, this is ultimately the principle of opposition, which will be entirely replaced on Earth by that of collaboration, a triumph of life over electricity, a triumph of unification and harmony over friction. This is a change of all opposing forces into friendly and allied forces. Every temptation entails contact in a certain sense. Every temptation entails, this is very peculiar and beautifully put passage. I think it's incredible. Every temptation, when we're tempted, entails a contact, and in temptation we see something that is to be overcome, something that we are battling, and something that is opposing us. And within every beautiful temptress attempts to tempt a potential saint, and in this is a risk of the touch with the saint as an allegiance with them. So in the temptation there is this for the author, and this is brilliant, I think. Every temptation entails a contact. So what he means by that is every temptation entails basically the possibility and the acceptance in a way and admittance of that spectrum. So in the sense that you are tempted and aware and self-conscious of your temptation, like the temptation is risking a self-knowing of the fact that you know something is bad, therefore there is a contact with something better, higher, good. And I think that's so good. And you know, this is a risk of temptation for itself, is it? It risks allegiance with something better and higher. Okay, so in temptation is the imminent inverse of the fact of the evil of temptation, in the fact that it's only the bastardization of the good. So in the inverse, in the fact that in temptation you can see that which you should be doing, it's like contained within it. And so because evil is only the bastardization of the good, in a sense, the author's sort of saying that the good is always there and the temptation is risking you actually having contact with it. And thus, there is always the potentiality that within temptation there is actually an overcoming in the sense of realizing the good. And in this sense, we could speak of what it is for one to truly see. That is to say, to have eyes to see in relation to the higher quality. To have faith is to see in this sense of being able to see this whole picture of unification once again, whereby doubt in opposition to faith is something which schisms and splits. And there's much more in this first lines with regard to silence. And the Archangel Michael, there's a short digression for those that want to read it. But we move on to the second line, which is, it doth penetrate every solid substance. And this idea of experience of an obstacle to our freedom of movement, okay, solid substances, psychic barriers, okay, a wall of stone would be an example of a symbol of something which is a solid substance which we struggle to penetrate, all right? Symbolically speaking, this basically means we construct psychic walls which become insurmountable with regard to our aim, with regard to our contact, with regard to our communication, with respect to this idea of synthesis, unity and harmony that we've spoken about. And what do we really see in this? Well, what we really see in this for the author is rigid intellectual systems which render people materially wealthy, but intellectually and sincerely quite dumb, because you are held under the power of many or a single or many, many psychic walls which have been built. The author, speaking very of his time, sees this in Marxist and Freudian systems, within which one is within this psychically built system that they can only sort of adhere to, which lend themselves to an interpretation of everything via a sort of neurotic impenetrable wall, right? Oh, how do I read that Freudianly? Or how do I read that via the Marxist lens, right? And there is, of course, this both a physical and psychic and mental solidity. All of these three forms are experiences which become impenetrable, right? And but the question then is, well, what is it about the force of virginity which renders things penetrable? And with respect to rigid intellectual systems, force won't occupy itself with the mental formation itself, but will allow itself into the heart of the person concerned, the heart itself being and tasted of life. And we've spoken about this before, about the fact that the head can't really ever think or speak without the heart first. Actually, everything goes through the heart first. And so the force is only to do with the heart. It doesn't get contained within the systems that you're then making in your individual will, like, oh, you know, I know this is right in my natural law written heart, and then it goes up to the head and you go da 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 da, and you create all these mental rigid systems of why you can or can't do certain things. But the heart, of course, has tasted of life and not electricity. The heart is of God, it's of love. And so forces of the heart and life will pass this breath to the head, breathing movement from the heart into this intellectual formation. And, you know, once again, no such thing as a separated head and heart. Okay. And so it becomes open once again as the heart breathes life into the mental rigidity of the head. Seeing once again the difference between the open and the closed circle, sort of emotionality actually being equated there with openness, and intellectuality or rigid intellectuality being equated with a closed circle, and the breath of life then dissolves the rigidity and sensitivity which comes via the frictions and hostilities and contradictions of the electricity of the material world. And so within this, we can actually see a body and soul difference, whereby there may be a case where the body retires and refuses to serve as the instrument of the soul, and the inverse, where the soul quits the body. And in the first case, the body expels the soul. In the second case, the soul refuses to make use of the body any longer. Okay, so one's death is because the body is unserviceable for life, because life simply cannot exist and retires from the body. It's the hardening of the body in relation to like an abidance to the rigid electricity, both physically and metaphorically. So if as the body adheres more to the electrical, hostile, schismatic world of the serpent below, that soul, that heart, that breath of life, it can't exist there anymore because it's not serviceable to its aims. And the author understands this in relation to sleep. When one sleeps, there is no longer the breath of life within the body. But he says there are several modes of sleeping. There is sleep and sleep, as he says. There is sleep of the righteous, sleep of the ordinary, and sleep of sinners. And the sleep of the night is, of course, good for health and good for the soul. And it is a reset that is refreshing. And this digression on sleep comes out of absolutely nowhere, and he doesn't expand on it. What is it about force which is important here? Because force is, as we've seen, is the intermediary in a way. It's the means of the above and the below in the same sense on and the same within the microcosmic level, right? The intermediary, if you like, between pure consciousness and manifestation, the idea and the phenomenon. And we can see this in relation to how being awake, being asleep, these two aspects, once again, the above and the below, life and electricity. Encapsulating all this, the author goes on to speak about spiritual traditions and conditions that they must adhere to find this sort of ground of commonality. Firstly, they must be founded from above, which is given explicitly by revelation, by this, the idea of legitimacy we've spoken about before. We see this for the author in living traditions such as the Benedictines, the Dominicans, the Franciscans, the Jesuits. Explicit revelation gives them the irresistible vocation, the source of their origin, their legitimacy, and their foundation. So it's the above legitimizing the below. But he also says, so this is one thing, it must of course be given from above, but it also must observe the Ten Commandments and be inspired by the ideal of virginity that we've spoken about, with the Ten Commandments constituting ten foundations, not only of a healthy moral life, but also of all mystical practice, sort of bridging the gap of how the body and the soul are to service, one is to service the other. And mysticism for the author, and I think this is actually a very, very, you know, finally a great definition of mysticism. Mysticism is simply the awakening of the soul to the reality of the presence of God. And this has to be made and understood in relation to these two foundations of legitimacy from above, and then the relation to the Ten Commandments, and its appreciation of this tradition, and appreciation of the experience of the past of people who've had this legitimacy, had it to continue. And this is what's meant by honor thy father and thy mother, is to honor thy living tradition because of its legitimacy and because of its adherence to the Ten Commandments. And it's an abstinence from anything which could seek to break this continuity and this schism with regards to tradition, which is with regards to legitimacy. So when we say thou shalt not kill, we understand that the continuation of this current is to be fundamentally constructive. It's to be continuous. We can't slice and cut tradition. When we say thou shalt not commit adultery, is to say that we will not commit psychic and spiritual adultery, to give ourselves up to cults and things which are part of the schism. Two examples there of what are meant by these commandments in relation to continuation. Thou shalt not steal is, of course, of still fundamental importance to the spiritual life. There can be no tricks. There can be no possession. Ultimately, there can be no rivalry. There cannot be this hostility, contradiction, and friction and conflict, which is found within the soul electric, what we've spoken about, and the waters of the serpent. The totality, then, of these Ten Commandments constitute the laws of life, of progress, of fertility in relation to virginity, and they are the adverse of the serpent, of the whore of Babylon, and of electricity. And so that is pretty much everything for this card. It's a peculiar card in the sense that I somewhat feel, I don't know where we got to, but it's a very constructive card. It's a foundational card, and ultimately force is a foundational card because it's force, right? It's like a fuel in a way. And so think about it in that sense. I mean, think about it once again, force in relation to the above, the below, legitimacy, but also something's been added to this split with the split between openness, closeness, the serpent, the Blessed Virgin, as these two differential things, possessiveness, openness, life, electricity. Once again, this split is becoming very, very clear, but it's not dualistic. Remember that. It's not one or the other. the one side always has the reins, always is always a win. The battle is already won. So some things to think on, some things to meditate on for those who are interested. Thank you all for listening or watching once again, and the next card will obviously be for patrons only, but for those that do support me, thank you all very much for your support. And for those that don't and enjoy the content, Hermetics runs solely from donations, so any support is very, very much appreciated. Thank you all for listening. See you again in the next talk.